I'm sharing a photo. This is, I want to start here because I think it portrays well what I want to say about Iran. In contrast to the large re-demonstrations we've seen, sorry, can I ask others to mute themselves? It's, I can hear lots of echo. So in contrast to the large demonstrations we've seen in Europe, in London, but especially in the Middle East, where, for example, in Sana'a yesterday, almost 2 million were on the streets protesting about Gaza. The demonstrations in Iran have been very few, very small. The picture you're seeing is Mehrabad Airport. It's an internal airport, and the people you're seeing are volunteering to go to Gaza. They've got some of them have their passports with them. Unnecessary, this airport doesn't have any outlet except to other Iranian cities, so you can't fly from here to outside Iran. And therefore, it's a complete waste of time in many ways to expect people to go to use this airport to go anywhere. The other demonstrations have also been quite small. There is a website in Iran which started around the 8th of 9th of October. I'm told someone at a seminar was telling us in Middle East Center. This on its first day, it had 1 million volunteers wanting to go to Gaza. Months later, it's still 1 million. It keeps crashing, coming back with 1 million. So obviously, no one in their right mind is taking that site and the 1 million volunteers very seriously. What is even more surprising is that there aren't state-sponsored protests about demonstrations about Gaza. Now, the sadder part of this is that, of course, the population in Iran is rather blasé about all this, not just apathy, but a level of who cares type of. It's not our war, it's not our struggle. Amongst some, hopefully very few, but outside Iran, much larger, amongst right-wing exiles, there is open support for Israel. I think we need to examine this because Iranians didn't always have this kind of attitude towards Palestine. Many of the people I knew in Kurdistan actually fought for the Palestinian cause with the PFLP and others. And we can look at this as yet another of the terrible consequences of the Islamic Republic. Why isn't there any protest? Well, I think there is. On the one hand, the level of fatigue from the constant political posturing of the Islamic Republic about Palestinian case, of course, the Palestinian cause. From the day it has come to power, it came to power 44 years ago, 45 years ago, the Islamic Republic actually, at the end of Ramadan, has a day called Day of Victory, Quds. And until last year, it was organizing these demonstrations, which were supposed to show the Iranian commitment to the Palestinian cause. It's always, as witnessed by many people who have talked, it's always been very strong on its anti-Israel rhetoric. And it claims to be, it is in the forefront of all regional struggles against the Great Satan, the United States, and Western supported injustices. Of course, much of this hyperbolic rhetoric hasn't corresponded to any concrete action. in at the time when the Islamic Republic was probably in the height of its anti-Israeli posturing in the 80s, we all heard about the revelations of Iran Gate, where there was some connection between Iran and Israel's arms manufacturers. I assume some of this plays a role, maybe not significant, but a role in the level of cynicism that Iranians' population have about their government's position on Israel. But this is a very unpopular government, a government that has faced major protests last year and suppressed those protests. So in such circumstances, especially for the younger population, the enemy of my enemy must be my friend. Therefore, the enemy of the Islamic Republic, Israel, US, must be my friend. And in this, as I've said before, and I don't want to repeat it, the lackluster attitude of the Iranian left hasn't helped. Very often, they've cooperated with this type of the enemy of my enemy must be my friend attitude, but also at times they haven't taken a strong enough position. Just to give you a level of how bad the situation is, the so-called Nobel Prize, Peace Prize winner, who unfortunately remains in prison in Iran and should have our sympathy because she is in prison, but she issued a statement about Gaza. This was after tens of thousands, not 30, but tens of thousands have died. And her statement would have made Starmer or Rachel Reeves quite proud. You know, on the one hand, there is Israel. On the other hand, there is the Gaza, the Hamas or Gaza, and so on, as if we are talking of equal partners in this terrible wars that is going on in Gaza. In addition to this, I have to add the fact that, of course, this apathy, this level of soft support for Israel, has also got its roots, its origins in the level of propaganda that the Iranian population consumes daily, 24/7, via satellite stations, at least two of which were directly linked to Israeli intelligence and the Israeli government. They have been presenting, not just since the Gaza War, but much longer, a very distorted view of the Palestine-Israel conflict. And imagine how bad is the situation that those who support Palestine say, well, at least BBC Persian is less biased. So you can imagine how bad the others are. There is also, at a time of economic hardship, the myth that Hamas and Hezbollah get all of their funds from Iran. I think it's well documented that Hamas's income comes mainly from Qatar and super rich individuals in other Persian Gulf countries. For Hezbollah, yes, Iran has financed considerably Hezbollah in its origins, but now, and I will talk extensively about that, I hope I won't bore you, but Hezbollah is now part of the Lebanese government, and it has become on its own, a major owner of capital, finance, real estate, manufacturing, and increasingly it is paying for its own military expenditure. And one thing one can say is that, of course, Iran exports or sends free arms to Hezbollah, but that's not the reason why Iran is facing and Iranians are facing economic harsh hardships. And so I think we should see the current situation in that respect, in terms of Iran's internal dynamics, the dynamics of the politics that govern the country. There is also, of course, the claims that Iran has in terms of what it calls and its allies call the axis of resistance, mehbar muqavemat. Both are words that are similar in Persian and Arabic, so it's used for both. And it includes the Assad government, the Syrian government, the Lebanese Hezbollah, the Yemeni political group Houthis. I don't call them rebels. They control most of the country. So unlike the BBT, I refuse to call them just as proxies of Iran or rebels. And Jihad Islam, which, just so that you know, is a Palestinian group, but it's not a Shia group. Again, the media gets this wrong quite often. Here, and especially over the last few months, we have seen very little coordinated or even what I would call effective isolated action by the constituents of the axis of resistance in support of the Palestinians in the hour of, in their hour of need. The declared objective of the axis of resistance was to oppose the regional, that's what their statement said, to oppose the regional influence of Western countries, Israel, the Arab countries of the Persian Gulf. However, the problem, I think, with the axis of resistance is that even before the Gaza war, Iran's rapprochement with Saudi Arabia and later United Arab Emirate, and as a consequence of this, other Arab countries had challenged the declared objective of the axis of resistance. We should not underestimate the fact that despite this lack of activity, this lackluster approach of the Islamic Republic, there are many forces, both in Israel, including the current government, but also neoconservative Republicans, maybe some Democrats, but mainly Republicans, who are very keen to extend the war to the Lebanese border and create a situation where Hezbollah gets involved and, by extension, Iran gets involved. We have heard Netanyahu making comments such as, "We are now in a double battle." And he was when he visited the border between Israel and Lebanon, and he was issuing threats to Iran and Lebanon. His Minister of Economy went further. He said, "If Hezbollah opens up a northern front in the war with Hamas, Israel will wipe them off the face of the earth." And he was here talking of Iran and Lebanon. Of course, that is true. I mean, if the war had gone to those, there would have been an escalation that currently the US administration doesn't want and Iran's Islamic Republic doesn't want. However, I want to make clear that I'm not in favor of a war that would have led, as the Israeli minister claimed, wipe off Iran or Lebanon, or Iran and Lebanon off the face of the earth. However, I think there is a problem here when, after so much pro-Palestinian rhetoric, we face a situation where the axis of resistance is showing very little resistance, but also is not even using other channels to express opinions. It's not even organizing serious demonstrations within the borders of the Islamic Republic or elsewhere to show opposition to what is going on. There is history for that. We have to consider the fact that Hamas and Iran haven't always been the best of friends. I think during the Syrian civil wars, they were on warring sides. Later, the situation changed. Iran had much better relationship with the Hamas leadership when they moved to Turkey and some of them to Qatar. But on immediate aftermath of October 7th, Khamenei was quoted after a visit by Ismail Haniyeh to Tehran that Iran was not aware of their plans regarding 8th of October, despite the fact that Israel kept, at least in the last early days, going on about this being an Iran-Hamas attack. And Khamenei added that therefore Iran cannot be expected to give much support in the current Gaza war. This was the earlier weeks, and maybe at that time it wasn't taken as too much of a rebuff for what was going on. However, I think as time has gone on, as the numbers have risen, as we face ethnic cleansing, as we face starvation in Gaza, Palestinians had expected a lot more from the axis of resistance. So far, in terms of diplomatic efforts, the only things that the Iranian government has done is go along with the November 11th summit in Riyadh in Saudi Arabia, where the axis of resistance leading the country, Iran, took a position that was exactly the same as the conservative monarchies of the region, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait. And really, it's very difficult to see Iran's position being very different from that of Saudi Arabia, despite the fact that obviously publicity about Iran dominates the agenda. In the months and weeks that followed, aware and conscious of the disappointment, especially in the Palestinian refugee camps, I would say in Beirut and elsewhere, we did see Iran encouraging or maybe being involved on what I would call low-level operations against US forces in Iraq and Syria. This was trying to maintain a very difficult balancing act, and on the one hand, restraining its proxies to do anything that might endanger the existence of the Islamic Republic, but for appearance sake, maintaining a level of anti-Zionist rhetoric that would appease the various circles, both within Iran and outside Iran, who expected a lot more from the Islamic Republic. Now, if you look at the Western media, there is always talk of Iran and its proxies. And I want to spend some time talking about Iran's proxies one by one. And I want to explain how, in many ways, the Islamic Republic is not in a position, in the case of the two most important forces, Hezbollah in Lebanon and the Houthis in Yemen, to dictate what they should do. Iran is in a position, in a much stronger position in terms of influencing sections of its supporters in Syria, not everyone in Syria, and not necessarily the entire Assad regime. It is in a position to influence the Shia military groups in Iraq, but it is not in a position to influence much the Hezbollah, which is considered by many as Iran's strongest ally in the region. And there are very good reasons for this. The alliance between Iran and Lebanese Shias goes back to pre-79 era. I don't know the details of the history, but it is Lebanon and south of Lebanon is one of the few areas in the Middle East where Shias have survived. And historically, before 79, many leaders of the Islamic Republic who later became leaders of the Islamic Republic or ideologues of the Islamic Republic, such as Shamron, did live, visit Lebanon and got involved with the Lebanese Shias. But as a population pre-1979, my understanding is that the Shia population of South Lebanon, if they were political, those who were political were closer to the Communist Party of Lebanon. And again, I presume it is the many disastrous mistakes of that organization that led it to its demise and the fact that its support base went to Hezbollah. Hezbollah's glorious time is probably 2006, where it succeeded in defeating the Israeli army, and most of the left remembers that as one of the few occasions, I think one of, maybe one of the only occasions, where the Israeli army was actually defeated. It's not just a military force, it is a political organization that has a social educational role in South Lebanon. It runs the hospitals, it does the food distribution, and so on. And it has an extensive network of charities that provides mainly for Shia population of Iraq. But over time, Hezbollah has become a far more important and serious force, and it has held a number of seats in the parliamentary bloc because of the way the constitution is in the sectarian constitution is in Lebanon, but it's also maintained ministries. My understanding is at least a minimum of two ministers in every Lebanese government since 2006. It is called the Shia organization. The Iranian diaspora likes to portray it as this dark force which has where everyone wears full chador, black wears black head cover, face cover, and so on. The reality is very different. The organization is extremely pragmatic, and nowadays it has very serious aims and ambitions in terms of its own position within the Lebanese economy, within the Lebanese political forces. If in South Lebanon there are still black-clad, veiled women, if you ever watch a demonstration or an election rally of Hezbollah in Beirut, you will see that young women are unveiled. They are usually blonde, they've colored their hair blonde, and they are fully made up. They are not only not veiled, they are wearing very open t-shirts. But this image of the black-veiled woman in South Lebanon and the Beirut middle-class young girl supporters is a reflection of Hezbollah's position in the Lebanese economy. On a general level, the Lebanese neoliberal economic policies has been considered, like everywhere else, both as changes in economic policies, but mainly restructuring of class power. And in that way, it differs very little from elsewhere in the region. The Lebanese government, with the support of Hezbollah over the years, has embraced policies of privatization, opening up to markets, accepting IMF loans, deregulation of labor and other markets, cuts in social spending. And Hezbollah hasn't just accepted and participated in these policies, it has actually consolidated the dynamics of this whole change And its publicity, its political propaganda often reflects this. So it's no longer the young radical clerics who wanted Iran-style political system, although the Iran-style economic system is very much reflected in Lebanon. The popular base of Hezbollah nowadays includes the growing Shia bourgeoisie and middle classes who want whose main aim is to maintain peace and improvement in political representation. So they want Lebanon to remain stable, the economy to recover from the problems it had in 2019, 2020. And when you look at some of the suburbs of Beirut, where Hezbollah is quite strong, you see many wealthier families that are part and parcel of Hezbollah's activities and institutions and provide mainly are active in various sectors, leisure, tourism. They're not even bringing their Islamic ideas to the kind of industries that they are involved in. It's not a bazaar, don't limit it to the bazaar. You can also see how this level of change in the economic attitudes of Hezbollah has made it popular amongst the professional classes, where engineers, doctors, architects proudly announce their association with Hezbollah. The group is also, it's got something called Friends of the Shia Lebanon or something globally, and it does get involved in gaining financial support from many Shia Lebanese wealthy individuals who live who are outside the borders of Lebanon. We hear very often Hezbollah's defense of the Lebanese free market economy. And if you want to know how its relations with the foreign or the exiled Lebanese Shia community in diaspora works out, you can look at the list of the businessmen sanctioned by US Treasury for association with Hezbollah, and you will see that there are large Middle Eastern and non-Middle Eastern African and global companies. Some of them, I won't name the individuals, but for example, there is the Inmar real estate companies. There is owners of car care centers that have branches all over the Middle East. There are shareholders of supermarkets in Nigeria, amusement park resorts in Africa. So you could say that the current Hezbollah is not the Hezbollah of 2006. It has become, in the word of some people who have studied Hezbollah's economic policies, a very bourgeois, they call it embourgeoisement, which is from French. And people like Haini talk of the Islam de marché, market Islam of the Hezbollah. And they admit it, they're quite proud of it. They're not hiding it. They're not claiming we are the party of everyone. They say Hezbollah is no longer Fayyad, Ali Fayyad, Hezbollah MP, said in the mid-2000s. 2015s. Hezbollah is not a small party. It's a whole society. It is the party of the poor, but at the same time, there are a lot of businessmen. We have a lot of rich people, some from the elite class. Now, this has created conflict with sections of Hezbollah supporters in the south, but nothing serious because many of them share the benefits of this. For example, there is a lot of reports from the south of Lebanon where people coming back from, especially those who went to fight in Syria and came back, complain about the fact that there is such a disparity between wealth and standard of living between ordinary people in South Lebanon and the sons and daughters of Hezbollah officials, who, according to people on the streets, show off their cars, their houses, their clothes. So you could say that what we are looking at is a complete integration of Hezbollah with the Lebanese state, and therefore it's the fact that Hezbollah sees its own future intertwined with the economic future of Lebanon. In terms of protests and demonstrations, wherever there has been such protest, Hezbollah has been on the side of the state. This goes back to, in fact, internally and ideologically, they argue it very well. They have argued that workers should not demand more than what is provided by the bourgeoisie, which who in turn has obligations, charitable obligations towards the poor. And in repeating some of the quotes from Khomeini, Ayatollah Khomeini, they say class struggle is a negative is a negative attitude, mainly because it divides the Ummah. Ummah is the general population, the general Muslim population. So dividing the Muslims between rich and poor creates and any form of class struggle, including some of the protests that were against neoliberal economic policies in 2019, for example, in Beirut and other major Lebanese cities. These are perceived as anti-Shia, anti-Hezbollah. In some ways, they are very good. They're even better than the Islamic Republic at defense of private property. It is because of that, I think, that we are not seeing a major involvement by Hezbollah in the current war in Gaza. It isn't that it can't do anything. It has got a lot of arms. It is well organized. It has a discipline. In fact, it has maintained, this is quite an unbelievable situation where it has maintained its social environment in the south of the country, but it's using it instead of opposing Israel or starting or supporting the Palestinians in support of what someone rightly pointed out, pious neoliberalism, self-regulation and entrepreneurialism. And I think for Hezbollah, irrespective of what Iran would have said to it, and Iran doesn't want Hezbollah to start a war, it's very clear from what I said earlier, Hezbollah would have not gone into any serious struggle against Israel. The same is true of Houthis for different reasons. Houthis, in terms of not listening to Iran, Houthis are most probably now the most popular force amongst the Arab nations. I don't I have no doubt that what they have done is the only thing that anyone has done in support of the Palestinians. It is interesting when you listen to the Western press and the radio press and read the press in the West, that the lives of tens of thousands of Palestinians is less significant than the fact that maybe, and only maybe, price of some items might go up in Europe or in the United States or globally, because ships have to go around Africa instead of using the Suez Canal. So we have to say that the Houthis have played an important role in this, but they are by no means proxies of Iran. In fact, on the contrary, pressure by China and other countries, including the United, including the United States, that indirectly has contacted, or maybe directly has contacted Iran about Houthi's attacks against ships in the Suez Canal. Iran has sent numerous messages, from what we read, to the Houthis, discouraging them from attacking shipping. And they haven't listened to this. And I think, again, this whole term of Houthis as Iran's proxies or rebels is completely misjudged. They have had, long before the start of the war in Gaza, the Houthis had military successes that gave them control of half of Yemen. The so-called official government, or the peoples that the US and UK and European Union support, are in exile in Saudi Arabia. They have no role in the day-to-day activities or military activities in Yemen. One shouldn't consider them, call them rebels or proxies. Here again, we have to remember that Yemen was the country that was one of the first countries where in 2011 there were pro-democracy protests, large crowds gathered outside Sana'a, in Sana'a, the capital, as well as many other Yemeni centers. And these demonstrations were against corruption, against poverty, a coalition of opposition groups managed to oust Saleh in 2012. Now, this led in its aftermath to a military intervention by Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates in 2015. And since then, the Gulf Cooperation Country and so on have supported the government in exile of Mansour Hadi. And Iran has recognized the Houthi National Salvation Government, mainly because of, again, pragmatic and opportunistic reasons for Iran. At the time, it was in opposition to Saudi Arabia, and it made sense to support the opposition. What isn't said is that, in fact, by the summer of 2023, the rapprochement between Iran and Saudi Arabia had probably paved the way for an end to the war, which until then was considered a major humanitarian disaster in the region, famine in Yemen, poverty amongst the population, and so on. In fact, it's probably the war has delayed that situation. I don't think Saudis are necessarily forever will forever support Hadi And the likelihood is that, as far as the Houthis are concerned, the whole concept of presenting themselves in this war, becoming a major force, is supporting their ambitions beyond the current situation. So it is that they are not limited by the issues in Gaza, although I do believe that given the massive demonstrations in the capital and other cities, it is in their interest to support the Palestinians. But they are in no way controlled by anybody else. And you can see that for them, this is a first step towards becoming a major regional force. They are seeing themselves as the future government of Yemen. It's telling that when the US tried in November, December 23, to form this alliance, a coalition against the Houthis, as UK and US were preparing for much larger bombings of Houthi installations, Saudi Arabia refused to join that. And some European countries refused to join it. So for Houthis, the current war, yes, they are under pressure from internal forces to support the Palestinians, but it's not just about this issue, it's for their long-term future. And basically, Iran can't tell them to stop it. Iran has tried to tell them to stop it. China has put a lot of pressure on Iran. It hasn't worked. So I doubt if that will go. In the second part, I want to just briefly talk of two of other forces that are considered Iran's proxies. And in here, again, you have to consider a level of, you shouldn't buy everything that Western press and media tells you, so there is a level of cynicism is necessary. Iran's support for Assad, as I've said time and time again, is not ideological. It's again purely pragmatic, it's opportunistic. The Saudis, as soon as there were protests in Syria, again going back to the Arab Spring, the Saudis supported the Muslim Brotherhood, which later Daesh, directly, indirectly, I'm not going into details. And Syria, events in Syria were not unrelated to what Daesh and Islamic State and ISIL were putting forward as direct threats to the future existence of the Iranian regime, Tehran. This was, for many, if you follow their publicity, Tehran was more of an enemy than Washington or Tel Aviv, for that matter. And so, irrespective of what the Iranian government presented in its publicity, you could say that they did believe, or at least sections of the Revolutionary Guards and sections of the Islamic Republic did believe that if they didn't defeat ISIS or IS later in Damascus, there was a threat to Tehran. Whether this their belief was justified or not, this fear they had was justified or not, is another matter. But they did see it in that way. They did send the most senior Revolutionary Guard, General Soleimani, to Syria to organize that. And as you know, the US at that time was saying Soleimani was the hero of the war. I think he was Time magazine's man of the year for defeating Islamic State. There is, yes, the Assad family, mainly because of colonial decisions, were a minority, they were Alawites. But Assad senior and Assad Bashar Assad are not Shia Muslims. Alawis are very different as a religion. They would have been facing some repression in Iran. Mrs. Assad, who goes around with no headscarf, would have been arrested even in 2022, 2023, 2024, if she went around as an official figure in Tehran. I know many people in Iran now don't wear the hijab, but not as the wife of a senior figure. So the fact that Iran supported Syria was because their main enemy, regional enemy at the time, was Saudis and Daesh, and that was the reason. This does not reduce the fact that the military presence of Revolutionary Guards in Syria has allowed Iran a level of, if you like, military presence in Syria after the end of the worst part of civil war, because if I understand it correctly, a low-level civil war is still going on, but it's not clearly the Assad regime, with the help of Iran and Russia, has strengthened its position in Damascus. Now, apart from the fact that Iran has this presence in Syria, Syria has done nothing, as far as I know, in terms of attacking Israel, defending the Palestinians. It's been, okay, they've done issued statements, they've gone to various Arab Muslim summits, but sent delegates to various summits. But as far as they're concerned, it's just allowed a rehabilitation of the Assad regime within the Arab community, leadership community. So it hasn't been, we haven't seen a Syrian military operation against Israel, except at very low level. Instead, what we have seen is that at least 15, as in my numbers, 15, I'm sure there are others who will give me a better, more correct figure. Senior IRGC, Iran Revolutionary Guard Command, military, what Iran calls military counselors, killed in various attacks in Syria since the start of the Gaza war. Now, these people are based in Damascus, or in the suburbs of Damascus in military compounds. Some of them are actually based within suburban homes, houses. The attack 10 days ago on a Damascus suburb that was apparently heard all over Damascus was by Israeli Air Force. The Russian Air Force had been warned that such an attack would take place. They did absolutely. There is a coordination. I'm reliably informed by Haaretz and other Israeli papers that there is a coordination. Israel actually tells the Russians, we are coming, there is a drone or there is a missile. It's attacking this force in Damascus. Russia has complete control of Syrian airspace, and the Russians take this as accepted. The drone comes, the missile comes, and the IRGC commander or his friends or the area where he lives, in this last case, two houses in a suburb of Damascus are completely destroyed. Now, the reasons why Russia accepts this is quite clear. If it didn't happen, we could have major international incident in that the Russians would bring down an Israeli drone or an Israeli plane, and as a result of this, we could have a US-Russia war. So Syria hasn't done much, but Iran has faced a large number, I would have said, a large number of senior revolutionary guard killed in Syria in the last 6 months, Iran's response, as far as I can see, has been zero. As far as I can see, I might be wrong. Maybe Iran is very successfully attacking Israel, and I don't know it, but I have not read, seen either in the government press or in the opposition, who is dying to get Iran and Israel fighting each other because they see this as salvation and they can get rid of the Kurds, or sections of the Kurds are very aggressive about this. If only Israel could attack Iran, we will get self-determination. Yes, well, let's save us from that kind of self-determination. Then we have Iran and Iraq. And here, I think Iran and the Shia armed groups in Iraq are very closely tied. Here, you could say they are proxies of Iran. Name them, Hashd al-Shaabi is one. They are also using in the attacks that eventually led to the death of three US military personnel in Jordan. I think they used Kataibul Hezbollah. They are Iraq's allies, Iraqi allies of Iran. And in the initial weeks and months of the Gaza war, I think these Iran had told them, yes, you can attack US troops, but it has to be minimal. It has to be what someone has called calibrated response by Iran. Calibrated in that, yes, we do something, but we don't do too much in case we endanger the future of the wonderful Islamic Republic. All of this changed after the Jordan attack. In late January, the Iraqi faction Kataib al-Hezbollah, or Hashd al-Shaabi, which has led, I would say, a dozen limited attacks against US forces until the Jordan attack. No one had died. I think the maximum we had was a contractor who was suffering headaches because of the noise of the missiles that had attacked a bit. But after that, they announced in late January that they would suspend attacks. And the group made it very clear that it was Iran and the ruling Iraqi parties, forces in government in Baghdad, that had forced it to take this position. They were unwilling to do so, but they were forced to, partly because the Iraqi government was putting some pressure, but they actually went out of their way to note their disagreements with Iran and its so-called axis of resistance. Iraq's Shia coordination framework, the government's main backer, includes Iraqi groups such as Asaib al-Haq that fought US forces since soon after 2003. And these groups obviously are still very resentful of the presence of US forces in Iraq, but they also have to be realistic in that the entire Iraqi government is a Shia government. It is in power thanks to US war in 2003 and the subsequent support of US for this government of allowing it to exist. So I would sum up by saying that Iran's position so far has been very limited, and it is, I suppose, expected. It has tried to pacify its own forces, both inside Iran and outside Iran, with slogans, with rhetoric, while remaining, in terms of practical action, very quiet. Of course, we don't know what are in these secret messages that the US keeps saying it is sending to Iran. Is Biden threatening Iran with nuclear attacks, with bombing of Iran's nuclear facilities, Iran's security, Iran's military forces? I think it has said, it has claimed that at some stage it will revenge the recent killings of IRGC members, Hezbollah allies. As a couple of senior Hezbollah people have been killed by Israeli forces. But so far, we haven't seen much of an Iranian reaction. Now, it is true that there are those, especially in Israel, who say that Iran is actually benefiting from the current situation. I have my doubts. Haaretz has an article, for example, last week saying, well, Iran is benefiting from all this. It has enriched more uranium. It is very close to a situation where it might be able to use at least one, to create at least one nuclear bomb. Its unity with Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates has had political and economic advantages, and at the same time, it is selling arms to Russia, which is true. Iran is selling a lot of arms to Russia because of the Ukraine war, and it has benefited from those. Having said all that, I would say Iran is not benefiting from this war in the long term. Unity with Arab rulers is very fragile. It could go away if the war continues in the region, and if Iran comes under more pressure from traditional supporters. But for the Islamic Republic, the whole last few months has increased loss of any credibility in the region. I would say that in the slogans we heard in the refugee camps of Sabra and Shatila, where is Iran, is reflective of that loss of credibility. I don't think it has gained any supporters inside its own borders. Ironically, like in the international situation, now you can judge who is who in the Iranian opposition by looking at the positions they take about Gaza. And for all their faults, the left inside Iran has remained solidly pro-Palestinian. The same can't be said of all of the exile left groups, but inside Iran, I think that is true. And in those circumstances, I think the Islamic Republic will, in the long term, pay a heavy price for this, what it calls our measured response to the Gaza conflict. Measured responses can have advantages, but they can also bring disrepute. And in this case, it certainly is bringing disrepute to the Islamic Republic and its claims to lead the axis of resistance. Thanks very much.